Hi, Bill. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Excellent.
Bill and I are trying to start a kind of bi-monthly week in review of what's going on in the Netroots and the blogs. And we have a whole host of topics today, starting off kind of with a topic that has been dragging out for, I think, 3 weeks now since the ad first came out. But we're starting off with Move On and their ad in the New York Times the Monday before General Petraeus testified, which was General Petraeus or General Betrayus. And I guess my question for you, Bill, is after everything that's happened now, you know, do you believe the ad was a mistake by Move On?
No, I think the ad was never the problem. The problem was how Washington Democrats reacted to the ad. You know, almost anything, any aggressive that anyone on the left does is going to be susceptible to a smear attack from the right. And the question is, what does the other parts of the larger liberal progressive democratic side of things, how do they react to that? And Washington Democrats reacted to it by joining with Republicans to attack Move On and making the ad's language the focus, instead of trying to put the focus back on the underlying point of the ad, which was that there were books being cooked. There was an article in the Washington Post a few days prior to the ad's release that talked about all the different ways that the military brass and the White House were cherry-picking statistics, distorting the picture on the ground in Iraq. And that was something you needed to do if you were to push back on the notion that everything that General Petraeus was about to say in his congressional testimony was the gospel. And since they didn't do that, they made the focus Move On and not the facts on the ground, not the policy. We're now 3 weeks in, still talking about this silly ad.
That's true. That the right definitely did pick up on it and use it as a distraction. But I guess that's my whole point, is that, you know, leaving aside the factual case for a second, could there have been a larger campaign between bloggers, the Democrats in Washington, to make that factual case? Yes, but if we're looking at the phrasing of the ad itself, you know, do you believe they made a mistake with the specific, not the rest of the case, but the specific General Petraeus or General Betrayus phrase?
Well, I don't accept the Republican conservative attack that to say that General Petraeus or General Betrayus is equivalent to saying he's a traitor to his country and is working with the enemy. That is not how I interpreted that phrase. To testify to Congress. So he's a public servant. I pay his salary. You pay his salary. When he testifies to Congress, he's legally obliged to tell the truth. And if he's not going to tell the truth, if he's going to give false information about what's happening on the ground in Iraq, then he is betraying his trust with me, the person paying his salary, and you, the person paying his salary. So that was a fair charge. And as a political matter, you do have to do things that are often edgy and aggressive if you're going to capture attention to the argument that you want to make. So you're always going to have to risk a little bit getting some blowback from your political opponents when you do stuff like this. And I have some sympathy to those elected officials in Washington that were uncomfortable with the language, but they could have handled that much differently. They could have handled it by saying, you know, I may not agree with the language in this ad, but the underlying point remains that the facts that he has been giving us, that the White House has been giving us, the military brass has been giving us the public, have not been fully accurate, and that's where the focus should be.
I think, you know, you can make that point that the Democrats should have handled it differently, but, you know, if Move On had to do it again, and you talked about how, you know, edgy attacks are necessary, etc., but, you know, do you really want to be making an edgy attack that will become that distraction that allows Republicans to have a talking point, you know, for going on 3 weeks now?
Well, this is the way that conservatives generally like it. There's a conservative correctness that's going on here. There's always a lot of talk about political correctness. All these liberals, they don't want us to be able to make racist or sexist jokes in the workplace, and we can't racially profile Muslims, and therefore we're not having a real debate about what's really going on in our country, blah, blah, blah. There's always those sorts of talks. But there's a whole host of things, a whole host of words and phrases that conservatives regularly attack as being out of bounds by their standards of civility. And it's often not really a sincere criticism on their part. I think it's just making mischief to try to make it harder for liberals to make compelling arguments and to capture media attention. So we're going to get, so if we play by their rules, we get it both ways. We can't make anything, can't make any pointed charges, because that's going to be uncivil. And if we try to do things, you know, super duper extra special, squeaky clean, no one's going to hear what we have to say. And so conservatives win either way, and we lose either way. So it's incumbent upon us to find a way to make aggressive charges that are fair. Obviously, you don't want to make anything up. I don't think this ad did. Fair charges, aggressive charges, and have a strategy in place to handle the inevitable attacks you're going to get from the right whenever you do anything.
But I guess my point is that sometimes fair and aggressive charges can end up backfiring. I think we can all agree that Frank Rich at the New York Times is not exactly a member in good standing of the conservative echo chamber. Yet, you know, he described the ad as a left-wing brand of juvenile name-calling that allowed the war's cheerleaders to hyperventilate about a sideshow.
To say that Frank Rich is a soldier in the liberal army is false. Not to say that his politics aren't generally liberal. They are. But he is, like many so-called liberal columnists, columnists first. A lot of so-called liberal columnists are often quick to find points of disagreement with other liberals to show off their independence.
But they also don't pull them out of thin air. I mean, that his analysis to go after, this point to, I guess push distance itself between him and the movement left shows that there was at least some type of, middle sentiment that said, yeah, this phrasing was over the line.
Well, that sentiment was generated. It was manufactured by the right. And since there wasn't any coordinate argument in response to that, the middle, quote unquote, generally accepted that storyline. And Frank Rich, I'm sure, is totally sincere in making that point of his. But I do find that there are a lot of times when people on the left are quick to criticize each other and show off their so-called independence, as opposed to taking a pause and saying, wait a second, what's really the more important point to be arguing here? He could have spent his column talking about the underlying point, as opposed to attacking move on and wasting everybody's time. So I would charge that Frank Rich was the one making the tactical mistake and not move on.
Well, let me try one last stab at this here. Considering that, Democratic politicians supported the net roots like Jim Webb and John Tester both, voted to condemn the ad. If you were sitting around a table with Move On, Netroots bloggers, Democratic leadership, and you were pre-gaming General Petraeus' testimony, and the Move On representative said, "We have this great ad. We're going to put it in the New York Times. This is the phrase." Would you, as a Monday morning quarterback, say, "No, that phrase is going to be a distraction. That's going to take away from our case. You should choose a different headline." Or would you say, "That looks great, let's go with it"?
I would have run it again. The only pause I might have had was I would have recognized that I'd be doing this by myself, and I'm not going to succeed in doing this as a team effort with a full Democratic community that's going to keep the focus on the policy questions and the lack of accuracy in the testimony. I would do it knowing full well I was out there by myself and not expect to get any support from people who are my supposed allies. But in and of itself, I see nothing wrong with the ad.
Fair enough. Moving on to another issue that came up in the Democratic debate on Wednesday. Actually, even before the debate, Bill Richardson ran some ads with some colleagues of yours. I hope I can call them that. Open Left's Chris Bowers and Matt Stoller, as well as Christy Sue O'Connell from Fire Dog Lake, all appeared in a television ad that ran in New Hampshire for Bill Richardson, talking about the importance of leaving no residual forces in Iraq. Chris Bowers has been talking about this for a long time. He's pointed out that Obama, Edwards, and Clinton before the debate had all said very, very similar things on the issue and all seemed very willing to leave substantial numbers. Numbers have been thrown about, but somewhere around 40, 50,000, 60,000 troops. You can check out their positions on Bill Richardson's website. but that, you know, all of them had committed to, you know, leading some type of residual forces there, and Richardson was trying to make the point that he was not. And lo and behold, the first question out of Tim Russert's mouth was on the very topic. And you had a post looking at the candidates' answers the next day, if you want to tell everyone how that happened.
Sure. I will make one point, though.
Okay.
I don't think it's technically accurate to say that another blogger is a colleague of another blogger. and I have to say that I disagree with, you know, Matt and Chris and Sugun being in the ad. But there is a tendency to say that what one blogger says is representative of every single blogger in the liberal blogger community or the conservative blogger community. And that is sort of, I think, undermines what the blogosphere is all about. You know, it's a cacophony of voices. Bloggers are only responsible for their own blog. I'm sure candidates would like people to think sometimes that when this blogger says something nice about me, that means the entire community is in full agreement. But it's not the way the blogosphere, it's not what the blogosphere is all about.
Well, if I could, we're getting off topic, but I'll just flip that around on you. The same could be said of the bloggers criticism of the mainstream media. You know, I'll call, you know, anyone from the Washington Post or New York Times a colleague, but, you know, everyone has different takes on the coverage and what's newsworthy and what's not. And we're not quite as monolithic as you guys might think. But, you know,
totally fair point, although there does seem to be at times, you know, patterns that happen amongst elements of the mainstream media, particularly those in Washington, that when you see them happening over time, you know, you call them as such. But it's always oversimplistic just to say, and I do this all the time, so call me a hypocrite if you like, but to say, obviously, I would criticize traditional media a lot when there are a lot of individuals that say McClatchy that do fantastic work, you know, on Iraq, for example.
Right.
And I do think that, you know, even though you might criticize mainstream media or traditional media at times, I think bloggers have been pretty good about finding those who do good work in the traditional media and elevating them as well. There's definitely great interest in that. I think everybody knows that if, you know, David Brooks or Joe Klein that says something, the criticism belongs with David Brooks or Joe Klein. It doesn't belong with every other single person that wields a journalistic pen.
So
I think the same thing applies with bloggers.
So after that sidetrack, we'll get back to the issue that your non-colleagues raised through the Bill Richardson campaign, and was then picked up by Tim Russert in the debate on residual forces. And you had a post the next day about Obama, Clinton, and Edwards' answers on that question.
Well, it's fascinating to me because, you know, Senator Clinton is on the verge of running away with the whole Democratic nomination.
Appears that way.
And I think that is because the main concern going into the primary was, can she win? Is she electable? This has been the perennial question amongst Democratic primary voters, for better or for worse, in the past several years. And her performance in the debates has been very polished, very poised. She doesn't make mistakes. She doesn't get ruffled. That has allayed those concerns. And there's also no polling data that you can hold up to say that she is a sure loser in a general election.
Actually,
so there's no substantive argument one can really make that she can't win.
If I can just jump in there, Pollster.com had an analysis of the CNN poll, New Hampshire poll done right before the debates, and it showed, you know, her only going up about 4 points as far as her lead over Obama, but she had jumped 17 points in electability. So it seems as though the more Democrats in New Hampshire see of her, the more they agree with you that she is electable.
And I would say she is. She's not my choice, but I don't think there's a strong argument to make that she can't, that she's unable to win. But at the same time, there's also polling data out there that shows that most Democratic primary voters believe she would get all the troops out of Iraq within 9 months of her presidency. And that is factually untrue. And just this past Sunday on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, she was asked point blank, would you pledge to get all U.S. troops out by the end of your term? That's January 2013. And she said, oh, that's a hypothetical. I can't answer that. And then she went off to tick off all the various remaining missions she believes that we need some level of troops to execute. So in my mind, this is the only opening. If you don't want Hillary to be the nominee, if you're one of her competitors, this is your opening. This is your shot. You know, Edwards has tried to make an opening in saying, I don't take lobbyist money and she does. And that doesn't seem to be enough to dislodge somebody from a fairly solid frontrunner's position. Obama has been saying she's too polarizing and I can bring the country together. That doesn't seem to be sufficient to dislodge her from her frontrunner's perch. But there is such concern about the direction of our foreign policy and our presence in Iraq. If you could make the case that she is not going to truly end the occupation and not going to truly change foreign policy, that to me is your best shot at reversing the dynamic of this race. And your first opportunity to do that was this debate that you mentioned with Tim Russert. Tim Russert asked, I think, the most appropriate question, would you take this pledge? And Edwards and Obama wouldn't take it. And so it makes me scratch my head and wondering what they think they can do to change the dynamic. And in some deference to Edwards here, he tried to make a bit of a nuanced point that he interpreted Clinton's comments to say she would continue combat missions in Iraq and he would not, because he considers that to be continuation of the war, and he got some press coverage for that.
Do you buy that distinction?
Potentially, it's hard to say because I mean, and to fully flesh out Edwards' point, he was saying I'm only going to have upwards of 5,000 troops there just to protect the embassy and humanitarian workers. That is a pretty low level, but it becomes a real question of one: do you trust this person is saying to me? And two, do you trust that they're going to qualitatively use those troops in the way that you're saying? You know, there's not a lot of Syrian troops in Lebanon, but the way they are positioned and stationed, they have the effect of occupying that country and manipulating that government to Lebanon's unfortunate situation, increasing their instability. So that's what you want to get at. And because there's so many ways you can fudge these questions, the only way you can be really sure is you say, I'm going to have zero. They're not going to be there. I'm going to clean break with this policy. And certainly by the end of my term, there is no way that if I'm replaced by a conservative president, that person can continue the current policy because it's over. So maybe Edwards is sincere about what he's saying, but he has a much more complicated argument to make now because he's not taking the clean, simple position that I will certainly have all troops out by the end of my first term.
Yeah, no, I mean, Matthew Iglesias wasn't too keen on the distinction either. You know, he was more the lines of, you know, you can't really keep just a few troops in there. They're going to be there very vulnerable. It has to be a lot or none. So why don't you think any of them are taking that next step and saying, okay, I'm, you know, going to go with Bill Richardson in and we're going to go with no troops in Iraq?
I have a hard time explaining why. I can only presume that they think it's the honorable thing to say. You never know what's going to happen. I don't want to box myself in and commit myself to something that I can't follow through. Worst case scenario is what's in Bill Salmon's new book that Bush got to them. And Bush told these candidates directly, don't box yourself in because you may not like what you see when you get to my position. And they fell for that. But it seems to me you could at minimum say, Maybe this is too daring for them to do. If I was in their position, I might say, if I don't get them all out by the end of my first term, then I failed in my goals and I won't stand for re-election again.
Yeah, I can pretty much guarantee you they're not going to promise that.
Well, it just seems that's the biggest issue of the day. It's on everybody's mind, and you're leaving a huge opening if you can't. I mean, this is not like saying I refuse to take all the troops out in a year. I mean, you're talking 5 years from now. If you don't have a game planning to do that, it raises a lot of questions about why should I be voting for you. So now you have an opening for Bill Richardson or Chris Dodd or maybe even Dennis Kucinich. Those are the only three now that have made the commitment that they won't have troops there by January 2013. There are other flaws in those three candidacies. So we'll see if this issue is strong enough to launch them into the first tier. It's certainly harder for them if Edwards and Obama aren't joining them in that argument, focusing all the attention on Senator Clinton. When you've got sort of three targets there, it's a little more diffuse and harder to see if that's going to change the dynamic of the race.
From my own perch, I have my own guess as to how. I mean, unstated, or I guess you already have stated that you definitely think that we should have no forces in Iraq. You know, very soon.
Well, I've said before, I did not make as hard a line as Matt Stoller and Chris Bowers and Sion did in the Bill Richardson ad. I could accept...
But you're in that ballpark.
I'm in that ballpark, but if you're going to say, look, I really need to have a temporary force there for a year or two, we got to wind this down gradually, we still have to train Iraqi forces, we still have to protect humanitarian workers that are there, those sorts, and there's still some Al-Qaeda remnants we have to deal with, I can understand that, as long as you are sincerely getting down to zero before the term is out. So I didn't think it was useful as a blogger trying to help crystallize the debate to be overly rigid in what's acceptable or not. To me, the true line of acceptability is, are you for a permanent military presence there or not? If you have a game plan to avoid having a permanent presence, you know, there's room within that could be acceptable to me personally. So Edwards and Clinton and Obama have all said no permanent bases. They've all said that much. And Edwards is at least saying, I'm really only saying, you know, a handful here for extremely limited missions. So maybe that's okay. But there's some fuzziness there that's disconcerting.
Well, one of our Matt Stoller, Chris Bowers, are two of the bloggers, main bloggers at Open Left. And the third is Mike Lutz, who admittedly worked in the first Clinton White House. But he is definitely a lot less no residual forces than Stoller and Bowers. And he put up five questions the other day on residual forces, and I just wanted to run quickly through them with you.
Sure.
What happens to the Kurds? Are we concerned at all about Kurdistan?
I mean, we should be concerned about the whole country, not just one region. So I don't accept that we should be looking at this like in a smaller prism. If Clinton has now said specifically she wants to leave troops behind specifically to protect the Kurdish region.
And you agree or do not agree with that?
I mean, I'd agree that we want the Kurdish region to be safe and stable.
Well, we want the whole country to be safe and stable.
Exactly. Occupation is an occupation.
So would you agree with leaving troops behind in Kurdistan to make sure that stays stable?
If you are leaving troops there on an indefinite/permanent basis, it is impossible to separate that from the political ramification of that act. You can say all day long it's just for defensive protective reasons, but if you are the linchpin of security of that government, then you have control over that government.
So
and there is inherent instability and resentment that comes along with that.
So the Kurds are on their own and you're fine with that?
I mean, I don't think on their own is the right phrasing here. I believe they should be part of an independent sovereign Iraq. I believe that we should have a diplomatic and economic strategy to help them as much as possible. And to bring about regional cooperation there. But to say that I need to have an indefinite military presence to achieve that completely ignores the political ramifications of that act. And we've seen that now. We've now seen for 5 years the kind of instability that's created when you have an occupying presence. You know, we had 7 soldiers that were an op-ed in the New York Times a couple months ago, soldiers that Rush Limbaugh would call phony soldiers because they disagreed with his position, that said that the Iraqi people see us as an occupying force, and that is the fundamental problem here.
Do the Kurds see us as an occupying force as they do in the rest of the country?
I don't know if you can separate that out. I mean, the Kurdish region is definitely more pro-American than the Sunni regions and the Shia regions, but you are still occupying a region of that country where there's a good deal of natural resources that people care about. So I don't know if the Sunni or Shia side would say, I don't care that the Americans are in that region, not my region. They're still affecting the political makeup of the country.
Okay, let's move on to the second one. We got 5 here. If the UN and other countries really get engaged in 2009 and a peace deal is forged, do we refuse to send back troops as peacekeepers?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
If the UN and other countries really get engaged in 2009 and a peace deal is forged, do we refuse to send troops back in as peacekeepers?
No. I mean, if it's a UN situation or otherwise international situation, and there's no tint of occupation involved, it's a wholly different political situation.
Okay, so we got a quick answer. We're moving on here.
Okay.
3, any concern about the humanitarian workers in Iraq and their safety?
Of course, but I have concern about humanitarian workers all over the world. The hope would be that the end of an occupation and the replacement of a wholly different strategy would bring about the kind of stability that you wouldn't have to have a soldier flanking every humanitarian worker in that country.
And so I assume the next question is, what about reconstruction? You probably feel the same way about that, that there would be a net benefit into security to humanitarian workers to construction so that Iraq would rebuild if the troops left.
You want to help with reconstruction however you could, but helping is not no-bid contracts to American companies that aren't giving work to Iraqis.
Gotcha. Okay, so moving on from Iraq, well, actually not too far. we'll start talking about the Joe Lieberman amendment to the DoD appropriations bill. And the amendment, the core of it encouraged the State Department to name Iran's Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. This would give the State Department more leeway to target the leaders of the Revolutionary Guard, banking, etc., and otherwise. And Hillary Clinton voted for this amendment. Jim Webb voted against it. Barack Obama was campaigning. However, his spokesman, Bill Burton, said he would have voted against it. However, him and Dodd sponsored a very similar amendment earlier in the year. What is your take on the meaning of this vote for Hillary, and what if any opportunities does it open up for the rest of the field?
Well, similar to her pledge, her refusal to take the pledge not to get all troops out, this was a possible area that could weaken her frontrunner standing. And Edwards tried to take advantage of it during the debate, saying we can't trust this president to give him even a smidge of authority to move towards a military confrontation with Iran. And Jim Webb, Jim Webb and I may not see eye to eye on the Move On ad, but let's face it, he has been the strongest voice on national security matters of the Democratic Party in the past year. And he made very clear during this debate that this, by classifying the Quds Force as a terrorist organization, not that the Quds Force is, a sweet bunch of guys, but as a legal matter, it could give the administration legal authority to take military action against them and move towards a broader regional conflict, and therefore it should not be approved. And for Senator Clinton to vote for that, puts her in a little bit of a precarious position. I don't think as precarious as the refusal to take the Iraq pledge was, because Iran is still an over-the-horizon issue, and Iraq is right in front of us. But it certainly raises an eyebrow. And it raises an eyebrow again, talking about how Democrats are handling national security in general. This is clearly this is not even a binding resolution, but this is part of a larger propaganda campaign to lay the groundwork for confrontation with Iran. And you're not seeing any coordinated Democratic strategy to rebut that and counter that and put forth a different way to deal with the problems that Iran is posing. And Jim Webb, I thought, was making a very sharp and comprehensive argument of what to do, but others in the party are not treating him as the sole voice on this, and therefore there's a fracture in the party, making the overall message coordination shaky.
And what about in the net roots?
Well, net roots is beside themselves, I think. I don't want to speak on behalf of the whole community again. I'm not by any means.
Well, I cover them. I can say that they're pretty upset about it.
A lot of the reason why bloggers became bloggers is because they felt the media was doing such a poor job in being skeptical and being investigative and being aggressive in what the administration was saying. And there are a lot of concerns in the run-up to the Iraq war that a lot of misinformation was being put out. And now it feels like we're seeing the same script being run. And bloggers in general can't understand why a lot of folks in Washington aren't recognizing that and acting differently than they did 5 years ago. When you make a mistake, you try to learn from it. It seems like there are a lot of folks that haven't learned from it, and that's very disheartening.
Yeah, reading the reaction the next morning in the blogs, I thought the whole residual forces issue ended up being a muddle because, Obama declined to even, make a distinction, and then Edwards, in my opinion, kind of muddled his. But then when the Iran vote came up, I thought really that was going to be the one everyone was going to run away with the next day. because it just seemed like such a, you know, a repeat of the 2003 authorization for military force. It was it for I like you said, you know, for a lot, I can imagine a lot of people in that roots going, you know, oh my God, we've seen this movie before, we know how it ends, and we don't want to go there again. I've seen some people take it up. Do you expect Edwards to make more of an issue of it? And do you think Obama is too tainted by his earlier resolution with Dodd supporting pretty much the same amendment that he couldn't use it as a cudgel against Hillary?
I haven't read that past amendment, okay. So I can't speak about that, you know, too intelligently. But I think the candidate that is able to not, I mean, you know, the amendment is sort of just one piece of the puzzle here. You know, if you get focused on a Lieberman-Kyle amendment, which hasn't even gotten all that much media attention, period, I don't think it's got quite the amount of salience that you would need.
That's true. But, it's got a bad name. You guys need to work on that.
Right. But the larger question about, I mean, everyone's trying to show that they can lead, that they have national security chops, and they know how to counter the inevitable attacks they're going to get from the right. If you can show that you have an alternative strategy for dealing with Iran, and I think to some degree Edwards and Obama have done that, and I agree with some things that they've said and not agree with others, but they're generally trying to do that, but I don't think they've quite broken through and made very clearly that I have a game plan here that is wholly different than what we've seen in the past 6 years, and therefore you can trust me that I'm going to be able to take on the kind of attacks that I'm going to get from a Giuliani or Fred Thompson or Mitt Romney or what have you. The person that can do that best, I think, has a chance to upend Hillary Clinton here, but again, because of some other dynamics, that might be impossible.
Yeah, I would just say, to stay kind of topical with the day, it's appearing more and more that's not going to be John Edwards. I don't know if you paid attention yesterday to Edwards' announcement that he wouldn't accept matching political funds.
I did see that.
But as soon as he did, Marcos and John Singer over at Mighty D quickly had posts up saying, you know, this isn't doable, this is a terrible decision. It just doesn't make Edwards competitive anymore. The backstory being that if you accept matching funds, you have a cap on the number you can spend. I think it's around $45 million, maybe $50 million. Until you get the actual nomination, which means since both conventions are in September, Edwards wouldn't be able to spend a lot for that whole summer until he got the general election funds in September. And then Coase got some feedback from the Edwards campaign and wanted to do some more analysis and crunch the numbers. But then he's come out this afternoon and said, okay, no, I've looked at it. I officially cannot vote for John Edwards in the primary.
Well, you know, there's some segment in the blogosphere that gets very focused on the nitty-gritty of campaigns, the fundraising, the grassroots organizing, and that sort of thing. I find it very difficult as an outsider to be able to properly judge those decisions.
Well, let me put it as simple as possible for you. Coase's argument is, I want a Democratic candidate that is going to be able to outspend the Republicans by the time the nomination is wrapped up, probably sometime in mid-February, and September, and that person's probably going to be, he hasn't said this, but he said his two options left were Obama and Dodd, and he's already said enough stuff about Dodd's electability that I'll let you guess who he's going to end up voting for. But ultimately, he wants a candidate that's going to be able to spend more money than the Republicans between mid-February and September, and so I don't think it's too much of a detail to say with, you know, his, you know, that's his case, and his point now is that Edwards just can't be that person.
I think I still think there's too much emphasis on this point, because it's not so much a question of having to spend as much or more. It's a question of having enough to make sure you're getting your message out. And I'm not concerned that the eventual nominee will be so broke and so strapped and have no access to free media and have no capabilities at all that person can't get his or her message out. And so what's more concern to me is, does that person have a good message and a good set of principles and an ability to communicate them that can be more qualitatively important than the quantitative aspect of money? That person, to me, I think can overcome any nominal financial disadvantage But again, I'm not wholly convinced of which candidate that person is right now. But I think the person that can show that could overcome that kind of money issue.
Fair enough. Let's move on to our last topic, which is the bloggers. What can the networks do to help get SCHIP passed?
SCHIP, this is the State Children's Health Insurance Program, and this is something I've been blogging about a lot for Campaign for America's Future at ourfuture.org. And this is, you know, there's not too many domestic policy issues that have been able to break through and get the people's attention because Iraq and Al-Qaeda and national security are so dominating all the time, understandably. But this is a pretty big issue, and Bush is taking a very, very politically dangerous position that many people in his own party are befuddled by in vetoing an expansion of this program, because you have a program here that works. You have a program that's been in place for 10 years. It covers 6 million kids right now. The rates of uninsured children have gone down over the period where rates for uninsured adults have gone up. You know, so this program has fought the tide of healthcare inflation and been able to cover more kids.
Well,
we still have a remaining problem.
But
we still got 9 million kids that remain uninsured. The common sense, logical thing to do is to build on something that works and expand it. And that's why you have so many Republicans that have voted for this in the Senate and in the House, along with Democrats. You have 43 governors, both parties supporting it. But Bush is still going to veto it. It looks like he could sustain that veto in the House. He can't sustain that veto in the Senate. So the House is where most of the political pressure would need to be. You need to get about 20 more Republicans to make sure you can override this veto. And so this is the question, you know, what role can blogs play? This, I think, will be a bigger issue in the media after the veto. Bush vetoes so rarely, and to veto essentially against kids is going to raise some eyebrows. So you'll get some media coverage out of that. Can blogs be an add-on and drive some of the initial outrage towards those Republicans and see if they actually get this over the hump? I wouldn't necessarily say you should expect bloggers to be the sole factor that can make this happen. Yeah, a lot of things need to happen. But there haven't been too many policy areas where blogs have been able to make an impact because things have been so screwy in Washington for so long. Here's one that we may have a shot at.
How do you envision, you know, just for one, you know, one concrete example that you could think of, what would be one way that lefty blogs could help pressure House GOPers to change their mind?
I think the main thing is just to keep the issue alive. You know, it's hard to get. I mean, you know, again, bloggers are not an organized community. Everyone does their own thing, and there's a lot of distractions going on at all times. But there've been occasionally you get an issue that happens that everyone kind of, you know, instinctually snaps to and focuses on it. And that, you know, take something like, you know, the Valerie Plame scandal. Here's something that the media largely ignored for a good long time. And because blogs sort of stayed on top of it, it maintained a level of interest, maintained a certain amount of pressure, and I think that made it harder. You know, it's possible in the prosecutor purge that Fitzgerald could have gone on the whack if it wouldn't have been seen as, you know, a complete political move. Because there's a certain amount of attention generated around it, I think blogs have a large role to play in that. That kind of political play could not be executed. And, you know, same thing with something like, you know, Social Security privatization. There are a lot of policy discussions happening on the blogosphere that really changed the perception about whether the program was in crisis or not. So there's things that blogs have been able to do to keep attention alive and focused, and that can help build political pressure. And we'll see if that happens after this veto or not. There obviously will be some media coverage initially. Can blogs keep that moving?
Let me ask you a kind of policy, and I guess it is a tactical question as well. At the corner, a lot of the contributors there have been posting emails from purported business owners who have been saying that, you know, if this SCHIP expansion passes, since it now extends coverage to children of people far above the poverty line, that they would just go ahead and stop offering health care to the dependents of their employees because there was no reason to, since the government now covered them. Do you see this SCHIP expansion as a backdoor, Medicare for all plan by Democrats? And then if you do, you know, tactically, are you fine with that?
you know, these sort of, you know, conservatives have been making these sorts of arguments. I've been tracking this on my blog for a while. They've been doing this since early August, and they haven't moved the needle at all in public opinion, and it's because they're so detached from reality. You have 9 million children currently uninsured. Has a large number of people who do not have insurance. And so when your main argument is this program is going to make people drop insurance they have and pick up government insurance, it is totally detached from the reality of the situation. It's hard to envision, and I think there's studies that show this might happen, you know, to a small degree. For the most part, if you're happy with the insurance you have, why would you go through the rigmarole of dropping it?
Well, if you're a business owner, it's because you don't have, it's a lot less you have to pay each month.
Well, this is the other point about what we're talking about here. Even though over the last 10 years the rates of uninsured children has gone down, it's been ticking up the last 2 years. And that's not because of any weakness in SCHIP itself. It's because employers are already getting out of the game of providing insurance, or at least providing decent insurance. So that's why you have all these middle-class families that either don't have insurance at all or have insurance that's so nominal that's not useful to them. So, and there are plenty of people in this situation. So when you have conservatives saying, creating this odd, you know, boogeyman that this is going to make them drop this wonderful insurance that they have, or businesses are all of a sudden going to drop it as if it's not happening already. This is going to cause a problem that already exists. You know, it's so disconnected that it's not really resonating with the public.
Would you be fine with the larger idea of kind of, you know, this program originally was for just children in poverty. Now it's kind of children under middle class. What about extending it to all children?
Well, this speaks to a larger point. There should be a healthcare system that is truly universal for children and adults. Absolutely. Right, just build it off of this program, you know, probably not. You want something that's more comprehensive that would also play a role in keeping healthcare costs down. When you're doing a system patchwork like this, this is what we're doing right now, this is a patchwork system, it's hard to have the same amount of cost control. You don't have any kind of bargaining leverage that you would have otherwise. So that's why it's actually very interesting. You have very detailed universal healthcare plans from Hillary Clinton, from Barack Obama, from John Edwards, not to mention Dennis Kucinich, who has the single-payer plan. You know, very detailed plans pretty early in a presidential campaign. And that seems to be because there is such heightened concern about this issue, particularly amongst Democratic primary voters, they felt compelled they had to do that. So I don't see SCHIP as a backdoor kind of thing. I think you need to have a separate legislation that's going to reform the entire system. And in lieu of that happening, because that hasn't been able to get accomplished in the past 10 years, this is just the best thing you can do in the interim.
Fair enough. Let me ask you one more question to get out on. Like you said, it looks like a veto. If Bush did veto, it looks like the Senate could override it, and the House is a lot closer. However, when it's come to stuff like FISA, the House and Senate have rolled every time. And, you know, Matt Stoller has been reporting that, you know, his sources in the ACLU have been hearing some very bad things coming out of Democrats' intelligence committees on both the Senate and House side. Why do you think the backbone of the Dems in Congress have been so much stronger on SCHIP than on issues also important to the Netroots like FISA?
Well, this closes the circle to where we started the conversation. The Democrats in Washington don't have a well-fleshed-out set of principles that people understand involving foreign policy and national security. And therefore, they end up being very trapped in conservative-created frames on these issues. So they've been very reluctant to try to push back at these frames and create their own for the public to choose from. So they get rolled. They get rolled. Whereas on more kitchen table bread and butter issues, people have a better sense of where Democrats will take the country, and they're more inclined to trust them on those issues. So building the trust on national security requires a real well thought out long term strategy that hasn't been there. And so when it's crunch time and there's a vote on Capitol Hill, they tend to cave. It drives us in the Netroots nuts. But until we put in that collective thought and execute some you know, some groundwork in advance, that's going to keep happening.
Okay, I guess we'll end it there. For next time, we have an assignment for the Netroots, and that is develop a coherent foreign policy position so the Democrats can better frame foreign policy debates.
Excellent. Always great to talk to you, Con.
Always great talking to you. Hopefully we'll meet again in 2 weeks.
Excellent.
Talk to you later, Bill.